This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for joining us for Talk Louisiana. Signature support is from First Financial Tax and Accounting Services, and we begin our program today with Chip Klein, the chairman of the Coastal Protection and Restoration Authority Board. He's been with CPRA since 2008. He worked under the former leader, one Garrett Neal Graves, now congressman from the 6th District, and he is working now hand in glove with the Democratic administration at the Capitol and John Bel Edwards as governor. And we're going to talk with Chip about a few different matters. And if you have a question about anything involving the coast, this is the person to talk with, 877-217-5757. But last week, if you got your advocate on Tuesday, actually just yesterday, there's a front page story, Diversion aims to save off loss of coast. Mid-Barataria project to create 27 square miles of wetlands by 2050. The advocate story says, picture an hourglass lying on its side, the top resting in the Mississippi River to capture the sands of time floating downstream from the Midwest. The sand flows through the neck of the hourglass and empties into the Barataria Basin, where scientists predict it will create and nourish freshwater marshes and saltwater wetlands to stave off an expected dramatic loss of Louisiana's coast over the next 50 years. That's the concept behind the Mid-Barataria Sediment Diversion Project, $2 billion proposal to rebuild a basin that has been eroding for more than a century. Now, the governor is all on board. He has an editorial in today's Advocate expressing his support. And the lieutenant governor, Billy Nungesser, who, as we know, is not usually a bomb thrower, 2 days ago, he opined in the pages of the Advocate saying he opposes the project. And we'll get to the pros and cons, but Chip Klein, you're an advocate. Why?
Well, first of all, Jim, thank you for having me on. It's been a while. But I'm a proponent for this project because this project, in its most simplistic form, is all about recreating the natural process that built the state of Louisiana to begin with. So all we're doing is going back, mimicking the process that over thousands of years built the land we stand on today. And so our land loss crisis started in this state when the Mississippi River was levied. That is a fact. It is undisputable. There are other factors that have contributed to land loss across South Louisiana, but our primary the primary driver of land loss is our lack of sediment. And so it's the beautiful thing about sediment diversions is the fact that we will create tens of thousands of acres, as you just said, 27 square miles of new land, roughly, any depending on what the environmental scenarios that you're looking at, anywhere from 20 to 30,000 acres of new land. So this is a project that actually matches the scope and scale of the problem we face when it comes to our coast disappearing.
877-217-5757 is your Talk Louisiana number. You may send emails to talk@talklouisiana.org. Governor Edwards, in his advocacy of the Mid-Barataria Diversion Project in today's newspaper, writes, "This is about the survival of our state, and the people of Louisiana deserve forward-thinking leadership and the peace of mind that decisions are being made to protect them today, tomorrow, and for generations to come." A question is, if we don't do this, are there other ways to get it done?
So this is our best hope. And so there are other project delivery mechanisms that we are deploying within the Coastal Protection and Restoration Authority. All we've done up to this point in the coastal program is dredge and pump sediment, where you're dredging sediment from the Mississippi River or the Atchafalaya River or from areas offshore, and you pump that sediment inland to create land. And you've seen that in recent press articles from the marsh creation projects we're building, some of the barrier island work that we're restoring that first line of defense. But the problem with that delivery mechanism or the project type is the very second that you finish those projects, or the very second that those projects begin degrading and deteriorating. And why is that? Because you don't have anything to nourish it or to sustain it and to protect it. And that's about what these diversion projects are about, is that you're going to create tens of thousands of acres of new land but you're also going to sustain the existing land that's in place today, and you're going to sustain and protect the land that's building that we're building through some of our other dredging projects. And we know this, Jim. Every area that is connected to the river today are the areas that are actively growing and accreting land. Mm-hmm. So you look at the Wax Lake Outlet, the West Bay, areas that are further south along the Bird's Foot. Those are the areas that are actually accreting land. Every other area across South Louisiana is losing land because it has been disconnected from the rivers and the sediment load that those rivers carry. So I think the governor is correct in saying that this is literally about our survival. This is about a cultural heritage. It's about a way of life. It's about a working coast. And so while there are other delivery mechanisms that we can deploy, those are all short-term solutions. Reconnecting the Mississippi River is a long-term solution for the overall sustainability of our coast.
Now, Lieutenant Governor Nungesser wrote, "I believe the better and faster way to save our coast is by building land now through dredging and restoring barrier islands and ridges that once protected our communities from storm surge." He continues, "I'm concerned the diversion project is nothing more than another insider deal designed to provide a few well-connected power brokers with huge contracts at the expense of every Louisianian." Is that hyperbole, or does the Lieutenant Governor have a point?
I would say hyperbole. I'm not going to question the Lieutenant Governor's motives for writing that, but I'll tell you this, Jim. There are decades and decades of science. Every single federal and state study, that has been done on the overall restoration of coastal Louisiana has called for sediment diversions and reconnecting the Mississippi River. And so one of the pillars of the coastal program that I'm most proud of is that we maximize the role of science and we minimize the role of politics. And that's something that doesn't sit well with many legislators in the pointy building downtown. Is that, look, we're going to follow the science. We're going to go where the science leads us to. And for decades and decades, the science has called for reconnecting the river. And so you can look at all the literature and studies that you want to, but just go to the areas around Wax Lake Outlet in the Atchafalaya Basin. Look at the sediment source that is in that Atchafalaya Basin. They got more sediment than they know what to do with in that basin. And so the Lieutenant Governor has called for us to restore barrier islands. Hundreds of millions of dollars have been spent in recent years in restoring those barrier islands. He's called for us to build ridges and berms. CPRA has done that. So everything that the Lieutenant Governor has asked is calling for us to do, we've been doing that over the last several years. But again, those are short-term solutions. Those are immediate fixes to the problem we face. And if we don't implement sediment diversions, if we don't reconnect our rivers to our marshes and our estuaries, we don't stand a fighting chance to win this battle.
Again, 877-217-5757, your Talk Louisiana line for Chip Klein, chairman of the Coastal Protection and Restoration Authority Board, 20-person board that looks at the coast, and this is our salvation. It is an existential threat, and Governor John Bel Edwards says land created by sediment diversions will sustain our massive marsh creation projects and protect our formidable hurricane protection systems that are being tested like never before. And this, of course, is an issue that has many components to it. But if we don't do anything, what would happen in 50 years?
Well, it's a thought that keeps me up at night. And so the fact is, Jim, since the 1930s, we lost 2,000 square miles of land. That's approximately the size of the state of Delaware. If we do nothing, the state of Louisiana stands to lose an additional 4,000 square miles of land.
In 50 years.
In 50 years. And so I think there are too many people, Jim, that live in the state of Louisiana and even in South Louisiana who don't fully appreciate the importance of South Louisiana to the rest of the Gulf Coast and even the importance of South Louisiana to a large portion of this country. if you look at the economic assets, the national economic assets that are housed across South Louisiana, the fact that 90% mm-hmm. of the oil and gas that is produced in the Gulf of Mexico is serviced out of Port Fouchon, 70% of the oil and gas that is produced is actually transported through the Louisiana Offshore Oil Port, through to refineries and other processing facilities. 90% of the nation's grain, our fisheries, are ranked 1 to 2 nationally. The strategic petroleum reserves that are housed, 5 of the top 15 ports are in coastal Louisiana. So it's important for the public to understand that this is not just a conservation issue. This is about the overall economic health of a large portion of our country and our overall survivability of the people who call South Louisiana home.
877-217-5757. We'll spend a bit more time with Chip Klein, chairman of the CPRA board. We're talking about the coast in Louisiana, and we're back in 90 seconds with more Talk Louisiana. This is Jim Engster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. Matt Doyle producing. Still time to get in with Chip Klein, chairman of the Coastal Protection and Restoration Authority. The number is 877-217-5757. We're talking about the Mid-Barataria Diversion Project, the core, in the story from Mark Schlepstein of The Advocate, says the project will create 27 square miles of new marsh and wetlands by 2050. Additional sea level rise is likely to reduce that to 21 square miles through 2070. So there are various components affecting how this project would evolve. It would be built at River Mile Marker 60.7, just downriver from the Phillips 66 Alliance Oil Refinery and the proposed Plaquemines Liquids Terminal, and just upriver of Irontown and Myrtle Grove. 877-217-5757. Cecile in Lafayette. Cecile, you are on with Chip Klein. Hi, Cecile.
Hi, good morning. Thanks for taking my call. I have two questions, actually. First being, could this water diversion plan be a yes and, along with Billy Nungesser's continuing to pump and dredge? And then secondly, are there any communities impacted by building up this new land? Would there be any communities along the river that would be impacted? Thanks.
Well, thank you, Cecile, for the question. If I heard the first question correctly, is the approach a both and or an either or? And the answer is it's a both and. It's about implementing the sediment diversion and continuing the work that we're doing, which is the work that actually Billy Nungesser is calling us to do. So it's about reconnecting the river and continuing to dredge and pump that sediment to create land and restore our ridges, our marshes, and our barrier islands. On the second part of your question, there are areas in the immediate footprint of the project, the Myrtle Grove community, areas around Ironton, Happy Jacks, and southern Plaquemines Parish, that will see some increased tidal flooding as a result of reconnecting the Mississippi River and diverting that water. And so as part of the permitting process, what we're looking at doing is deploying mitigation measures. There's over $300 million. This is a $2 billion overall project, but $300 million is set aside for mitigation purposes and initiatives. And so where we'll be raising homes, raising roadways, raising bulkheads, things of that nature, so that we're mitigating all of the negative impacts that would be associated or realized as a result of implementing the project.
Wade on O'Neill. Wade, you're on the air with Chip Klein. Hi, Wade. Wade, good morning. Okay, let's try Kevin on Fairfield. Kevin, you're on Talk Louisiana. Hi, Kevin.
How you doing today?
Hi.
Yes, I want to know why that is infrastructure. Why the senators and the people who stay in those areas are not pushing the senators, and where is Cassidy and Kennedy and Congressman Graves them in this? Why they are not on here talking about this and nobody bring it to their attention? And when you say vote for infrastructure, those same people are saying vote no to everything.
All right. What about our congressional delegation? Are they on board?
So Congressman Graves, Senator Cassidy, Congressman Scalise, the overwhelming majority of our congressional delegation that represent the southern perimeter of our state have been overwhelmingly supportive. number one, of our efforts within the Coastal Program, and number two, all of them recognize the importance of the Mid-Barataria sediment diversion, and they've been helpful with us on working with the Obama administration, the Trump administration, and now the Biden administration as we go through the regulatory process to get this project built. So I would say that the congressional delegation, particularly Congressman Garrett Graves, has been tremendously helpful to us.
Let's try Wade on O'Neill. Wade, good morning.
Good morning. I can barely hear you, but I hope you can hear me. But I was wondering what the short-term effect on fisheries, primarily shrimp and oysters.
So there will be an impact. I want to be very honest and very transparent. There's going to be an impact to particularly oyster farmers. Obviously, oyster farmers rely on a certain salinity regime to harvest their catch. But the important thing for the public to realize is we shouldn't be harvesting oysters and catching brown shrimp and catching speckled trout where we are today. As our coast continues to disappear and salt water continues to intrude, all of those things move further inland. And so what the modeling shows is that there's going to be a short-term impact. We're not going to destroy fisheries, but what's going to happen is we're going to hit reset. We're going to reset our fisheries and our oyster industry and our seafood industry back to where we were harvesting seafood and catching fish and seeing marine mammals swim back where they were 20 to 30 years ago. The downside, if we do nothing, if we don't implement this project, our ecosystem is going to continue to collapse. Mm-hmm. Our estuary is going to continue to fail. And as a result, the habitat for fisheries is going to continue to collapse alongside it.
Michael Orr writes, how is the CPRA mitigating impacts to the historic community of Ironton next to the proposed diversion?
So in Ironton, again, that was a water level tidal flooding issue where we'll be looking at raising roads, elevating structures, increasing bulkheads. And the important thing, I believe the question came from Kevin. Is that correct, Jim?
Michael.
Michael, excuse me. All of the mitigation measures that we are deploying are actually being developed from the ground up. So the residents and those individuals that live in Ironton and Happy Jacks and Myrtle Grove, they are advising us on what they want to see us deploy and fund as it relates to mitigation and addressing the negative impacts.
All right. Phil in Jefferson Terrace. Phil, you're on. Please be brief. Hi, Phil.
Good morning, gentlemen. So we've had like 100 years of oil and gas as our main source of energy. It's going to take about another 100 years to restore the wetlands. I think it's a matter of who pays, like the taxpayer or the oil industry.
Who's going to pay the $2 billion?
So the Mid-Barataria project is being funded by the BP oil spill settlement. And so there is a whole host of entities that are involved in that have oversight of the dollars from the BP settlement, various federal agencies, various state agencies, mm-hmm. and all have said that this project will actually mitigate the harm that was done to our coast as a result of the BP oil spill.
All right. Ike and Gonzalez says, would the Mardi Gras breach let nature do the same thing as being proposed by this project?
Yes. So Mardi Gras Pass is actually a natural cut that the river made. There was actually a controlled structure there that blew out, I think, back in 2010, 2011 timeframe, if I'm not mistaken, where the river has now been reconnected to that marsh. And what you see there is substantial growth, substantial vegetation, and you're still catching fish mm-hmm. in those areas. So this would be similar to the Mardi Gras Pass. However, the Mid-Barataria sediment diversion would actually be a controlled structure with a strict operational regime tied to it.
Lang writes, if we do diversion projects but don't address climate change, what does the science say will happen to our coast?
Well, so I think excellent point, and that's why you've seen the CPRA and Governor Edwards in the second term say that for far too long, the state of Louisiana has been reacting to the impacts of climate change, but not doing enough to address the causes of climate change. And so climate change is a political hot potato, as you know, Jim. And we can argue all day whether it's the natural cycle of the earth or man-made contributions, but you cannot deny the fact that the Gulf of Mexico continues to rise, and it continues to intrude upon our communities where people live and work. So it's reacting to the impacts of climate change, the projects that you see called for in the Coastal Master Plan, but then also addressing the causes of climate change. It's why the governor has set a goal for us to reach net carbon neutrality, reduce our overall carbon emissions by year 2050.
We're short on time, but what's the next step on this?
So we'll have the public comment period closes on June 4th. All of the public comments that would be submitted are analyzed and taken are vetted by the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers. They're their lead regulatory agency on this project. And then a final EIS will be issued in March of next year.
All right. And we look forward to having you back before then. But Chip Klein's an important guest doing significant work for our state. Thank you, sir, and please come back.
Thank you, Jim. Appreciate you having me on.
And we'll be back with Rosa Hawkins of the Dixie Cups. Then it's Mark Ballard of the Advocate after this quick timeout.
Go into the chapel and we're gonna get married. Go into the chapel and we're gonna get married. Gee, I really
who hasn't heard that song? And we're with Rosa Hawkins of the Dixie Cups. The book is Chapel of Love, the story of the New Orleans girl group, the Dixie Cups. And what a legacy this group has. 1960s, including the 64 million selling Chapel of Love and a flurry of other hits. And that particular song is one that one of the most famous in all of recording, written by Jeff Berry, Ellie Greenwich, and Phil Spector. It spent 3 weeks at number one on the Billboard Hot 100 in the year of 1964, and it is ranked, I think, number 279 on the list of the greatest songs of all time by Rolling Stone magazine. So, Rosa Hawkins, good morning to you.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine, and it's been a long and amazing voyage for you. How did it start?
Well, I don't know if you remember St. Augustine High School in New Orleans, Louisiana.
Yes.
It is a very popular all-boys school, and they would do a talent show, a talent show for everybody in the city that wanted to participate. And Barbara, my sister, was going to the supermarket one day, and this young lady told Barbara, she approached Barbara, and she said, "Hi, my name is Joan, and I sing." She said, "And I heard that you can sing." And Barbara said, "Yeah, okay." And she said, "Well, my brother and I, we're getting together a group to be on the St. Aug talent show." And Barbara said, "Okay." And she said, "We want you to be with us with our group." And Barbara said, "Well, I have to ask my mom." And, you know, she said, "I'm going home now and ask, I'll go home now and ask her, and then I'll let you know." So she went home and she approached my mom with it. And my mom said, "Okay." She said, "But, you know, she would have to find out who this young lady is, her family. You know, the old time stuff, you have to give up all of your family errands to be able to sing with them." And my mom said, "Oh, yeah. She said, I know her. I know her family." So Barbara went back and she told Joan and her brother Howard that, yes, she was able to sing with them. And they said, "Well, we need a baritone or a bass or something. And we don't have one because the young man that was supposed to sing with them, mother, took sick. And being the oldest child, you know, he had to do things for his mom, of course, so he couldn't be in the group. So Barbara told him, she said, well, my sister sang. And Joan said, oh, okay, what does she sing? And Barbara said, bass. And so we, you know, they laughed at that. So then they came to my house because, of course, Barbara and I, you know, were living with my mom. So they came to my house, and Barbara said, this is Joan Marie, and this is her brother Howard, and they're starting a singing group to participate in the St. Augustine talent show. And actually, I don't think, well, I know I didn't, but I don't think either one of us had even given that a second thought. We knew it was coming up because that was the buzz around New Orleans, you know, to be on the talent show.
All right. Well, you were originally known as the Meltones, correct? And that song, Chapel of Love, was written for Darlene Love, and it was rejected by Phil Spector, who didn't like the way it sounded, and he found you, or others found him, found you for him. How did you hook up with Mr. Spector?
Okay, actually, we never met Spector. This guy was at the talent show. His name is Joe Jones, and he's now deceased. And he had the record "You Talk Too Much," and he was at the talent show trying to find new artists, as he said. So on his program, he had circled our name, but there was another young lady. Her name was Barbara something. I can't remember. But he got in touch with her and wanted her to come and audition for him at his house. Well, Barbara, my Barbara, knew this Barbara, mm-hmm. and I'll say Barbara number one, which is the girl that was to do the singing, the auditioning. She asked Barbara number two to go with her. She said, because I don't know this guy, and I don't want to go to his house by myself. So,
all right. Well, as it turned out, maybe that was a good idea with Phil Spector. Cosette and Baker. Cosette, you're on with Rosa. Hi, Cosette.
Hi, Rosa. This is Cosette Weatherspoon Kaufman, and I am so proud of you. I'm going to get your book.
Okay, thank you. How are you doing?
I'm fine. Oh, I'm
good.
Glad to hear your voice. And I was so proud when I heard one time on NPR that you and your group had knocked the Beatles from the top of the charts in the 60s.
Yes. Yes, we did. Yes, we were blessed with that. You know, and it was amazing to us because mostly a lot of artists that start out in the music industry, they may be in the industry for about 4 or 5 years before they get their first hit record. And we were just blessed. We did Chapel of Love, and it went straight up to the chart to number one. So we hit it on the very first song that we did, and a lot of people, there were a lot of people that didn't believe. How could you get a hit from your very first song, you know? And I don't know, God was with us, I guess. And Mary Wilson, God rest her soul, we became very close friends. And she, you know, she was telling me, she said, girl, we worked for about 7 years around Motown as secretaries and background singers and anything else, hoping somebody would hear us and, you know, want to record us. So they did the, but she said about 4 years, 4 or 5 years, they would sing. And Barry Gordy always told them, no, go back and finish high school and then come in and try again.
The book is Chapel of Love, the story of New Orleans girl group, of the girl group and the Dixie, named the Dixie Cups, by Rosa Hawkins. It's an amazing tale of three black teenagers who conquered the music world right out of the great city of New Orleans. Eventually, Rosa, you located New York City, and the book is not all champagne and roses. You had some bumps and bruises along the way.
Yes, we did, and I was just a person. I didn't say a lot as to what was going on. I definitely didn't tell my mom because that was the one thing that Jill held over me, you might say, because he knew the type of person my mother was, and he knew that we were raised as young ladies, and we had rules and regulations that we didn't cross. And every time he would attempt to do something, he said, well, I'll call your mom and tell her that, you know, you've been with this guy and that guy. And he started naming different people from different tours that we did. So.
All right. Well, we do have to roll, but congratulations on remarkable work published by the University of Mississippi Press. Chapel of Love, the story of New Orleans girl group, the Dixie Cups, Rosa Hawkins, who never forgot New Orleans, and neither did her cohorts. And if you've been through carnival season, as most of us have, a time or two or three, you've probably heard this great selection from the Dixie Cups.
My grandma and your grandma were sitting by the fire. My grandma told your grandma, I'm gonna set your flag on fire. You're talking about henna, henna, henna. Aiko, aiko, ande. Giacomo Fino, annale. Giacomo Finale.
Thanks again, Rosa Hawkins. It was a pleasure, and congrats on your book. And we're joined now by Mark Ballard, Capitol Bureau Chief for The Advocate, who's down at the Capitol, where music is not wafting in the rafters right now. Sometimes conflict is the order of the day, and there's been a little bit of that. Republicans now have a supermajority almost in both houses, and Mark, they're starting to fight with each other a bit.
Yeah, I wouldn't say start, but the fights have become fairly intense with each other right now. So, the latest, I guess, now would be that the by invitation only conservative group, which would make up enough to block a 2/3 majority, have come out against this idea of extending the temporary sales tax that was tacked on in 2018 to balance the budget, and now they want to use it as a revenue source for doing highway and bridge maintenance. And they say they're going to block it. So it looks like the leadership, who are not quite as conservative as the members of this caucus are want this to go through. So it should be for an entertaining last, I guess, 8 days now. I got to go.
June 10th, a week from tonight, it's supposedly over and done. We'll talk more with Mark Ballard. It only takes 31 votes to block a tax in the House, and this revolution has over 40 votes, it says. We'll talk more with Mark when we return after this. This is Jim Inkster. Thank you for being with us for Talk Louisiana. As is our Thursday custom, we're getting the view from the Capitol from Mark Ballard of The Advocate. Your number is 877-217-5757. Bill Sintel has the story today above the fold in The Advocate. Although major hurdles loom, Senate leaders are behind a late-session push that backers say would go a long way towards solving Louisiana's longstanding transportation problems, including construction of a new bridge across the Mississippi River in Baton Rouge. The legislation started as a bill that would remove the sales tax exemption on therapeutic marijuana. It now includes a sweeping amendment that would extend the state's 0.45 temporary sales tax set to expire in 2025. The nearly $400 million per year would be earmarked for transportation, but there is a House group, a minority, but enough of a minority that could thwart this. And, Mark, at this point, it seems like it's a tough lift for those who are trying to get this through the process.
It'll be a tough lift. And remember that this bill that to extend the temporary sales tax has been sitting on the calendar of the House for months now, but they couldn't get the 2/3 votes because of the Democrats' opposition to Ray Garofalo continuing as the education chairman. And once that was taken care of, they sort of lifted that, and then you now have the conservatives in there. I think what the thought process is if it gets through the Senate, then that kind of gives it sort of a momentum, if you will, and in the final days of the House, that they have a better shot at getting the 2/3 votes. But that all makes for a lot of drama in the last few days.
And if you turn your advocate to page 3, there's Mark with another marijuana story. Smokable medical marijuana was backed yesterday in a resounding way, 76-17 in the House of the Representatives. This means it's going to the desk of the governor. What do you think?
Well, I think he's probably going to sign it. That's what all the indications seem to be. But it's remember back, I guess, was it 2015 or so when they set up the dispensaries and the growers and everything? They were so tight on that, and every year since, they've expanded it, and now we've expanded it to smokable versions, which at the beginning was, you know, absolutely never. And I think that it's going to continue to expand.
Sports betting package moving along. That's the story from Mark. This is something that some thought that conservatives would thwart, but it has not happened, at least not to this point.
They have raised some, particularly like the Family Forum, which is a very powerful among the conservative evangelicals, have been against it, but they haven't really leaned into their opposition against this particular one. And in fact, today will be the bill that will allow this to happen, perhaps by football season. That's what they're hoping for anyway. There'll be a vote on it in the House. The vote, the story that you're talking about is how they're going to disperse the money once they get it up, how it's going to be all divvied up. Well, that doesn't necessarily need to pass for sports betting to begin.
Well, in Mississippi, sports betting pulled in $15 million last year, and Mississippi has about 60% of the population of Louisiana, so I think $25 million might be a comfortable goal for the state of Louisiana, and that's real money. Now, Mark, the governor could very well force a veto session. He seems inclined to veto the transgender athletic bill. And he seems inclined to veto the no permit for a concealed carry right. Where are those going right now?
Well, I wouldn't be surprised to see a veto of that. But interestingly, over the Memorial Day weekend, the fourth floor shut down on Friday. And so they didn't accept any of those bills, those two particular bills that you're talking about, weren't accepted on Friday. That means that they came up on Tuesday, and he has 10 days to either sign it or veto it. And if you do your math, then that means that the session will have adjourned by the time he has to make a decision on that. And as we've seen in the past, over the last 50 years maybe, that the legislators are not keen about coming back to do override veto sessions once they've left. Now, there was a danger of it if he would have accepted it on Friday. There would have been a danger of him vetoing it while they were still here. That could have led to an override, but coming back, the odds are that they won't come back to override a veto on transgender.
You never know, though. It is Louisiana.
But you never know. Yes, this is true.
Yeah. Now, Jeff Landry, the Attorney General, has been in the pages of the Advocate for any number of reasons, and he is against any edict from LSU to require vaccinations for students to return to campus in the fall. Here's our Attorney General.
Well, I can tell you what, as long as I'm the Attorney General, we're going to be making sure that LSU students are not mandated to be vaccinated. Because if LSU attempts to put this into place, I'd have to then go into court and try to get an injunction against them, which certainly would be disappointing.
All right, Jeff Landry sticking to his guns, and could be a collision, Mark.
Well, and there are members of the Board of Supervisors that are against this. What we need to recall here is that these vaccines were allowed under an emergency order, and because they're under an emergency order, you can't mandate them, or at least the public entities can't mandate them. Interestingly, my son's college, which is a private college, has mandated them, but they can't because they're a private college, but the public universities like LSU cannot. And once the FDA takes them off the emergency status and makes them regular status, then they could be mandated like TB shots are. Mm-hmm. So, but for the time being, it's an issue, and it's an issue over the vaxxers and the anti-vaxxers.
And Jeff Landry has been revealed to be being paid well to be a member of a board while serving as Attorney General. The Advocate, Andrea Gallo, I think, is the lead reporter on this, who's been on the trail of Jeff Landry, and those two have been in court by virtue of Mr. Landry suing Ms. Gallo. But anyway, what's going on this front?
Well, apparently, and they've asked the Ethics Board if this is possible, and apparently they've gotten clearance on it, but one of his main political financiers, Shane Guidry, down on the West Bank in New Orleans, has put Landry on the board of one of his companies, and I believe it's a paid position, and so it's a
big pay.
That has raised a lot of issues because that's just raised a lot of issues, and I guess right now, until somebody forces him off, that he's going to stay there.
All right. Well, last week, some were surprised that Bill Cassidy stuck to his guns and voted for an investigation of the January 6th insurrection, something John Neely Kennedy, his Senate cohort from Louisiana, did not do. He voted against it, as did Garrett Graves, as did Steve Scalise, as did Mike Johnson, as did Clay Higgins, as did Julia Letlow. Bill Cassidy appears to be an outlier in his own party. When it comes to this, in at least his own party in Louisiana, and only, I think, four Republicans in the U.S. Senate voted for the investigation, Mark.
Well, he is, he's kept to his guns, and like Ms. Cheney, you know, said, this is what I believe, and this is what I'm going to do. He's already been criticized by Trump.
Donald Trump, of course, loves him some John Kennedy and says he will campaign for Senator Kennedy. He's already endorsed him, and that election, by the way, is next year. It's 2022, and this is June 3, 2021. So a year from now, presumably, either Senator Kennedy will be on the trail seeking reelection, or there will be a cast of thousands seeking the office that he would vacate. Any scuttlebutt about where we are with that race?
I think what he's trying to do now is freeze people out of from running. And if he wanted to run for governor, right, he could wait, you know, in 2023 and have a free run. You know, but right now, that's up in the air. I don't think there's too many people wanting to challenge John Kennedy.
Well, he's very good at raising money, and he's popular in Louisiana. Polls indicate that. But if he ran against a fellow Republican, it might come down to who got more of the Democratic vote, and that could be tough for Kennedy because he's managed to irritate some Democrats. I wonder why. I wonder why, Mark Ballard.
Yeah, it's a... He has, he's always been very politically accommodating. And so he's moved from being, a very good Democrat to being a very Trumpian Republican.
That's right. He fired his staff a few years ago because he thought they weren't conservative enough. And now he is the darling of Fox News, one of the best known U.S. senators. And he could run for president of the United States in 2024, but he probably would have a better shot of getting the Republican nomination if he were a sitting U.S. senator. So I would think he's quite likely to seek reelection. He does turn 70 years old this year, which means he'd be 71 next year when he runs for reelection. And if he were to run for president, he would be 73, but that would make him 5 years younger than the current occupant of the White House. So, Mark, we'll see.
Age does not seem to eliminate people anymore.
So. All right. And I'm told the process for public comment on the Barataria project is today. So we hope if you're inclined to do that. Thanks, Mark Ballard. Signature support from First Financial Tax and Accounting.